Good day and welcome to Letters in Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. Radical anthropologist David Graeber is here. As an activist, David Graeber was known for his role in helping kick off the Occupy Wall Street movement back in 2011, helping coin the term, "We Are the 99%. He's the author of such books as Debt, The First 5,000 Years. And his latest book is called, well, it's called a name that I can't legally say on the radio airwaves. So let's say we'll just call it the book B.S. Jobs, A Theory. Now, you can imagine what the B stands for. Well, I can even say that on air. It stands for bull. Mm-hmm. The second word I can't say, even though I could, if this was a podcast, or if this was satellite radio, or if this was cable television, just not on terrestrial radio frequency that hardly anyone is listening to any more anyways. David Graeber also teaches at the London School of Economics. David Graeber, it's great to see you again. Thank you for being here.
Well, thanks for having me.
And I would never invite you on this program and censor you. So you can say the title, the full word of the title,
really?
As much as you want.
Are you going to beep me? Or
Yes, we'll have to go out and we'll have to bleep it out. Mm-hmm. Let me just say about that, if you say it enough, right now I'll probably bleep it out, but if you say it a bunch of times, then my producer will probably, and she'll end up bleeping it out. And let me just say, that really is a BS job.
That's true.
Right? What
is it? Would be a duct taper, I think, according to my technical stuff.
What are BS jobs?
Okay. The way I define them is basically from the perspective of the worker. What I say is, if you have a job that you secretly believe is entirely pointless, you're convinced that if this job didn't exist, it would make no difference whatsoever to the organization, to the world, or perhaps, you know, if this entire industry disappeared, the world would be a better place. But it also is something that you can't admit, right? Hence the BS element. You know, you have to pretend there's a reason to be doing this, but secretly you believe there isn't.
So what kind of BS jobs are there?
The largest area for BS jobs is office work. I mean, clerical, administrative, managerial, supervisory jobs, that sort of thing. There's a lot of other people who believe their jobs are pointless. Not so much service industry. You know, you'd think that retail people are sitting there saying, why do people buy this stupid nonsense? Well, no, for the most part, those people didn't come to me and say, I have a pointless job. What you did get is huge numbers of people who are in things like medical or health administration, who are in consultancies, HR, PR, but also telemarketers, corporate law, people like that.
Now, this began as an essay.
Yes.
That ended up taking a life of its own.
It did. It's actually kind of funny how the thing originated, because I sometimes say I consider myself an anthropologist in two different senses. One sense, the obvious one, that's my job. But the other sense is I don't really come from this kind of background. I don't come from an academic background, even a professional background. I come from a much more working class background, actually. And I've always felt a stranger in these kind of environments. And often I'm very much made to feel that I am a stranger. But So what do you do when you're in a strange environment? You act like an anthropologist. You try to figure it out. So what do you do all day, you know, Mr. Executive-type person? You know? And you meet people all the time who are sort of, maybe they're the spouse of a colleague and some friend who's at a party of somebody. And you say, what do you do for a living? And I'm an anthropologist. And they'll say, oh, nothing really. You know, and you think they're just being modest, they don't want to, like, talk about it because it's not very interesting. But if you press them a bit, sometimes you will discover that they meant it literally. They actually do nothing. They sit there all day and sort of pretend to work, or they work, maybe do 1 hour a day, sometimes 1 hour a week. You know, if they're there, if there's a problem, but otherwise they're just supposed to sit around and pretend to do something. And, you know, it's like the worst part of any real job. You know, if you're a dishwasher or something like that, and you know, there's no dishes to wash, they'll make you pretend to do something, mop up the floor just to look busy. Because so these people, 95% of their job is that, you know, they only get to actually wash the dishes 5% of the time, otherwise they're pretending to mop the floor that's already clean.
And that actually happened to you.
Oh, yeah, yeah. This is
your first question.
Yeah, yeah, that was the story.
It's a dishwasher.
Yeah. But, you know, the worst part of any real job is having to pretend to work just because the boss doesn't like you to see you just sitting around on his time, as it were. And you know, I suddenly realized that a lot of these professional-level jobs, these managerial jobs, that's all they do. The entire job is pretending to work. I mean, what must that be like? And so I wrote this little piece, and I sort of said, well, maybe this is the reason that we're not all working, you know, 15-hour weeks. Like Keynes in 1928 wrote this famous essay predicting that, you know, I guess it's still 10 years from now. In 100 years, he said, you know, we'll be working 15-hour weeks. Machines will be doing everything for us. You know, we could have that.
We could.
Yeah. I mean, like, if you look at the jobs that existed in 1928, most of them have been automated away. So why are we all working, if anything, more than we were then? It seems like we just made up these pointless, meaningless jobs just to keep us busy because we can't imagine what it would be like to not to work, or because we feel that, you know, anybody who doesn't work is a bad person, so we're just going to make it up. And you know, how it happened is a complicated story, but that was what ended up happening. So I wrote this little piece, and it was for a anarchist feminist magazine called Strike. They had a new issue. They said, oh, you know, just throw in anything you want. And I was like, you're serious, right? Anything. Okay. You know, I kind of had this list of, like, favorite pet peeve rant pieces that no one would possibly publish. And I said, okay, I'll pull one out of my hat here. I got one of those. How about this? A work rant. It is about on the phenomena of BS jobs. And they ran with it. And I was astounded because I wasn't expecting a big reaction. I thought people would be amused. And it was almost a test to see how many jobs like this are there. The response was insane. The web site kept crashing. It was getting millions of hits. Within 2 weeks, it was translated into at least a dozen different languages. It was coming out in Estonian, Korean. People were sending me these notes saying, oh my God, like I got this across my desk 18 times just today in my finance job. And it's like, wow, you guys really aren't doing much, are you? If you're just circulating this article to each other all day looking
for it. And a poll was conducted.
Yes.
Inspired by your...
Yeah.
So were you involved in that poll? I was not.
No, that was YouGov, which is like Reuters. It's like, you know, this sort of standard polling agency that does electoral surveys and things like that. And what happened was there was a guerrilla action where some people involved with Strike, I actually don't know who they were, but I can guess. Anyway, they went off and they put up these signs in the London Tube. This is the day everybody's coming back from Christmas vacation. So on the next Monday, they put up quotes from the essay. You know, it's as if somebody were just making up jobs to keep us all working. There are millions of people go to their jobs every day to perform activities which they secretly believe do not need to be performed. Various quotes like that from the essay. And they put them up in place of advertisements in the Tube. And this created something of a little media bubble. People got interested. Who are these? Somebody did a poll, said, tried to test it out, found the original essay, took some language from it, asked people, you know, does your job make any meaningful contribution to the world? And the results startled even me, because I was guessing, okay, even after the giant outpouring and the sort of piece going viral, I thought, well, okay, 20% maybe, you know, maximum, 25. But in fact, when they did the survey, 37% of all people who with jobs in the UK said they were quite sure their job had no meaningful impact on anything. And only 50% were absolutely sure that it did. And I thought that was amazing, because think about all the jobs that no one would ever, ever say that. I mean, you know, if you're a nurse, if you're a bus driver, you know, if you work for the, you know, if you're a guy giving the information for the trains or something like that, you know, it doesn't even have to be vital, but just useful. It's just obviously useful. You're a mechanic. You repair iPhones. It's a useful job. And then I also realized that I gathered testimonies from people that service jobs, people don't feel that way either. You know, if you're serving coffee, almost nobody said, oh, why do they need a, you know, $5 latte? That's stupid, you know. People didn't say that. If they thought they were ripping people off, you know, one or two people wrote and said, you know, I was selling swatches. It's a scam. We buy them for $5 and we sell them for $500. You know, occasionally you get that. But unless they feel they're just like literally stealing from people, then people accept, look, if there's a market for it, who am I to say? So it's not service industry guys, and it's not people in obviously useful professions. So if 37% of all people think their jobs are nonsense, then pretty much anybody who's sitting there in an office who you think might secretly believe their job is pointless actually does.
And I imagine there are people who have jobs that it's not either this is a BS job or not a BS job, right? A degree's within it that maybe 35, 50% of the time I'm doing something I actually feel is useful. But then other parts of the time I'm doing this paperwork, bureaucratic work that I have no idea what this was really even for.
That's another interesting issue. Slate, again, I can't use the word, but French Slate actually coined the phrase, let's just say BSization. So in addition to the BS jobs, there is the BSization of real jobs. And there had been surveys about this. I think somebody asked Americans, workers, how much of their day is spent, and they broke it down actually doing their jobs, emails, useless meetings, useful meetings, they put those into various administrative paperwork. And it turned out that if you combine the useful meetings and the actual work, that about somewhere between 37 and 42% of the time office workers spend working is actually spent working. Less than half, distinctly less than half, more like not a little over a third. And similarly, I saw that surveys of European workers said that people who work 8-hour days are actually productive for about 2.7 hours. And actually, I'm convinced these phenomena are related. And this is actually important because, okay, look at universities. Universities have seen the almost unprecedented increase in the numbers of administrative staff. The numbers of administrators, like big shots, deans, vice provosts, guys like that, now that's gone up, but in proportion, in relation to the number of students and teachers. But it hasn't gone up insanely. But there's been this incredible spike, you know, like 248% or something like that, increase in the number of administrative staff. And basically, what this means is, there's this idea universities should be more and more like corporations. They should be run like the private sector. That means if you're an executive, means first of all, the managers take over. So if you're a vice provost, you're a dean or a deanlet, as they call them, you know, one of these sub-deans. All right, you're supposed to live like an executive. They hire them, they give them an executive salary, but they also give them 5 or 6 assistants, because if you don't have flunkies, you're not a real executive. So these guys show up and they have this little army of minions, and they don't have anything for them to do, because they hire the minions first and then they decide what those guys are actually going to do. So they have to make something up. And that's how suddenly, like, people like me, who are actually supposed to be teaching, have to do time allocation surveys. And write up long explanations of what the learning outcomes are that differentiate the graduate level and the undergraduate level of the same course. And, you know, all this kind of stuff, which is just going to get filed somewhere no one's ever going to look at. But it gives these people an excuse to exist. And a lot of the nonsense that's produced in real jobs. It's actually two things. It's one, this managerialism, where the managers have to have assistants, so they create these BS jobs, and the BS job people have to have some excuse to exist, so they make up BS for other people to do. But it's also introduction of competition into the process. And this is all part of the, you know, sort of neoliberal revolution where we're making everything more business-like and efficient, but it has exactly the opposite effect. So all of a sudden you have these little contests internally and people just waste insane amounts of time on them. Someone estimated that European universities spend the equivalent of $1.7 billion a year on failed grant applications. So, you know, if they just gave out the money, like, maybe it wouldn't be perfect, you know, to the very, very best projects, but, like, you know, they wouldn't be wasting billions on absolutely nothing. I mean, those billions could have been given to someone doing research, you know. And Hollywood is the same way, the development. I got a lot of stuff from screenwriters and people who work in TV and movies saying, you know, it used to be you just pitch your thing to a producer, he likes it or he doesn't like it. Now they make you do these contests where you have to, like, create advertisements and elaborate, like, documents and scenarios scenarios and films all about projects that don't actually exist. So all these movies that never get made, you know, you have to make up like advertisements for 7 different movies that you want to make. And then like they have another class of executives whose entire job is to judge between them. And they're just wasting all this enormous amount of time all for things that are never even going to happen.
The scenario you're laying out would make us think of what we've been taught about, that that's what happens in socialist or communist systems. Capitalism is a system of efficiency. Eliminates the waste.
Interesting, isn't it? I mean, basically, like, that was the line. We kind of won the Cold War on arguing that we don't do that kind of nonsense. We're lean and mean. We're efficient. And efficiency became the paramount value. In a way, even what it is you're being efficient about was secondary to the very fact that you're rational and efficient and well-oiled machine, you know? So how is it, one might ask, that the moment capitalism wins the Cold War, you know, the immediate result is we start acting like, you know, the Soviet Union in the most ridiculous days of Brezhnev, where, you know, you go to the store to buy a piece of meat and it takes 5 different people. One gives you a ticket, the other takes a ticket, you know, because they have full employment laws and they have to make up something for people to do. It's a really good question. It is interesting that, you know, the Soviet Union, being a supposedly proletarian state, created proletarian nonsense jobs, and we, you know, being a bourgeois state, are creating sort of jobs that make you look and feel like you're kind of executive class, sort of lower echelons thereof. So they're mostly white-collar workers because, you know, executives will pride themselves on how they are lean and mean, and they strip down, downsize, and speed up all the people who are actually productive. You know, the blue-collar workers, the drivers, the factory workers, you know, whatever. Those guys, yeah, it's true. Capitalism treats them in just the way that you imagine it would, if anything worse recently. But the way they treat the people who they feel are more like themselves, the office workers, is exactly the opposite. In fact, there's this incredible empire building within these large corporations where every executive's prestige and occasionally even salaries directly related to how many people they have working under them. So where's their incentive to get rid of people who aren't doing anything? There's none. It's exactly the opposite. In fact, I had efficiency experts would write to me and say, you know, I work for a bank. I have proposed 12 different plans, 15 different plans for how they could strip this down and make it more efficient. Every time some executive shoots it down because he would lose some power and prestige because they would have to fire some of his underlings. Every time.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
The white-collar jobs.
The white-collar jobs. Yeah. They add them. They haven't been subtracting them.
We're in conversation with anthropologist David Graeber, author of a number of books. His latest, the abbreviated version, BS Jobs, A Theory. That is what we are talking about. Tell me about then what you call managerial feudalism.
Yes.
You've alluded to this.
Yeah. Managerial feudalism is the endless accretion of these sort of intermediary positions. One of the categories of BS Jobs they list for taskmasters, which are supervisors who are supervising people who don't need to be supervised. So either they just sit there and do nothing, or they make up tasks for you to do, like, let's make up targets and have you, like, fill out forms talking about whether you met the target, which, of course, makes it harder for you to meet the target because you're not actually working, you're filling out forms. And I got a lot of people wrote to me saying, you know, I have a BS job, I'm in middle management. You know, I used to do this job. I know they don't need me to do what they're doing. Okay, so managerial feudalism is a concept I developed because I was trying to understand this endless accretion of these sort of intermediary positions. And it happens all over the creative industries. I was just mentioning Hollywood. Well, a couple scriptwriters, 3 or 4 actually, wrote to me saying basically the same thing. They said, you want to know why it is that movies nowadays tend to suck? Well, it's basically because they've created these, like, 15 different, like, creative vice presidents. And these, like, it used to be, it was fairly simple. You got your producer, you got your director, you got your writer. And they would work together, maybe not love each other very much, but there are only so many hands on deck. Now there's 15, there's 20, there's, like, endless guys. And they're wandering around in suits, and they all, like, want to have some excuse for their existence. So they all intervene and tweak the thing and, you know, change the script. And before you know it, it's just a complete mush. It doesn't make any sense.
Well, it's the same film over and over again with different stars, different places.
It might not have started that way, but it always ends up that way once all these guys weigh in. Yeah. And so that's one thing. But then I looked at it and I said, well, you know, it's not just Hollywood. Hollywood might be really bad, but where do curators, where the hell do those guys come from? Now, 30 years ago, there was artists, there was a gallery. Now it's like the curator's a star. These intermediaries, manager types, suddenly become the impresarios, become the stars. This happens in journalism. Suddenly they have producers in addition to just editors and reporters. I don't even know what they do. It happens in publishing. It happens in pretty much anything creative. They just keep adding these people in the middle. And I said, well, where does this come from? How does this reflect broader changes in our economy? I realize that actually, you know, our economy is now driven by the FIRE sector, finance, insurance, and real estate. And if you look at those companies, it's pretty clear what's going on. What's happening is they're grabbing some sort of resource, loot of some kind, and they're redistributing it. And it's much like a feudal lord will just sort of grab the loot and then give it out to his underlings. They're basically doing the same thing because, you know, if you have an economy that isn't based on manufacturing and selling things, or that becomes secondary to the major forms of accumulation of wealth, which are about moving wealth around, then it very much resembles that sort of feudal process of grabbing the loot and giving a certain share of it to your retainers, because in a situation like that, economics and politics aren't really separate. You know, you need to buy allegiance of people to be able to get away with distributing the loot, you know, in a way to which is to your advantage.
And that's what this is?
That's what it is. I mean,
distributing the loot.
It's distributing the loot. I think that's really true. Yeah. The elephant tea factory story. Did you see that? That's the one I thought really gave it away. There's a lot of people have discussed the Keynesian bargain, they sometimes call it. That after World War II, there was a lot of negotiation between organized labor and industry, and they kind of came up with a tacit deal. Sometimes it was even spelled out, like in Germany. I said, like, all right, we will work to increase productivity, but if productivity increases, we get a share. So productivity goes up, wages will go up proportionate to that. And largely that was stuck to in the 50s, 60s. First half of the 70s, around 75, if you look at the diagrams, it suddenly changes. Suddenly, wages just go totally flat, even decrease by some measures. Productivity continues to skyrocket. So question is, what happens to the increased profits that come from this increased productivity? Well, the traditional story is it goes to the 1%, and that's not entirely inaccurate. And when we first were talking about the 1% in the early days of Occupy, that's kind of what we meant. Is these are the guys who basically have monopolized political power. They give all the campaign contributions, but they're also the guys who have gotten the fruits of economic growth that hasn't gone to anybody else. So 1% of the population essentially has grabbed the means to turn wealth into power and power into wealth. This is all true. But, you know, in order to maintain that power, any intelligent robber baron, you know, anybody intelligent person who's managed to grab a lot of wealth by largely political means knows that you need to distribute the spoils to buy allegiance to some degree. Now, however self-conscious this is, who is to say? But I thought the story about this tea factory I visited in France really was, if anything, a paradigm. You know, this in miniature, this is what's happened to capitalism. This is a factory, Elephant Tea. It was bought up by Lipton. It's near Marseille. It's been occupied by its workers for years now. And this guy who was part of the occupation was explaining to me what happened. He said, well, you know, we had been working here for years and years, and there's this huge packaging machines and production line stuff. And he said, well, you know, we tinker with the machines and we kind of make improvements. And the workers had figured out a way to, over time, to speed up the production line by 40%, increase efficiency. So the profits shot up. Now, back, if this were the 50s and 60s, some of that money would have gone back to the workers. They would have gotten a raise. I said, well, okay, that doesn't happen anymore. They didn't give us money. They didn't even hire more workers. You think they might do that, but no, it didn't expand operations. Instead, all they did was hire more and more middle managers. So originally, there was just two. There's a boss, there's the HR guy, that's all they needed, ran fine. Suddenly there's like a third, a fourth, a fifth, somebody's got a cousin who finished business school, they hire this guy, they hire that guy, somebody has a friend. Before you know it, there's 16 different guys in suits. They're all wandering around the factory. None of them have anything to do. They all have little clipboards. They kind of stare at us while we're working. They're trying to figure out some excuse for themselves. Very common pattern. They hire the people, then the people try to figure out something for themselves to do. And they come up with various schemes. They don't come to much. So finally, they all get together and say, we got to do something to justify our existence. So they develop a plan to shut down the factory, fire all the workers, and move it to Poland. Whereupon the workers go into rebellion, and it's been occupied ever since. In a way, that's a paradigm for our time, for our times. All that money that's produced by increased productivity, some of it goes to swell the coffers of the boss and being, you know, put into financial speculation and all that stuff we already know. But some of it is just used to, like, hey, my cousin finished business school. Hey, why don't we just give him a job, make him happy? And before you know it, you have all these kind of flunkies and administrators, managers, like, wandering around looking for some excuse for their existence.
This is a managerial class?
Yeah, a professional managerial class, yeah.
And you argue that historically, people actually don't need to be managed.
No!
Which is going to be counterintuitive to what most people believe today.
Yeah, I know, because there's been this managerial revolution, so now managers run everything. I mean, to some degree, I was inspired in all of this by my father. My father fought in the Spanish Civil War. He was in the International Brigades. He was an ambulance driver, so they were based in Barcelona, and of course would go out to wherever there was a combat.
So it was the Abraham Lincoln Brigade?
Yeah, the Abraham Lincoln Brigade was, it was a higher level because it was the ambulance corps, the first evacuation unit. But so they were all different nations. He became fluent in Spanish, German, and, you know, English. They were all at the same time. But they're based in Barcelona. And so he actually got to live in a place which was run on anarchist principles. I always say this is one reason I'm an anarchist. You know, most people don't think anarchism is a bad idea. After all, they think it's completely insane. They assume that obviously people can't do that. I mean, yeah, it would be nice if there were no police or prisons and people just behaved themselves, but, you know, it would never work. Now, my father, having lived in a city that ran on anarchist principles, he wasn't an anarchist when he showed up, kind of left halfway there. But, I was never brought up to see anarchism as impossible, so why not be an anarchist? But the thing that always stuck in my head is he said, when the anarchists were reforming industry, they had a very simple approach. They just got rid of the white-collar workers. And, you know, if it turned out that, like, something was actually needed, they'd try to get somebody back or figure out if they could rotate someone to do that job. But basically, they just assume those guys are useless, get rid of them. And in 80, 90% of the cases, it turned out those guys weren't actually doing anything. And this is back in the 30s, you know, when things weren't anything like as bad as they are now. So I always had that in the back of my head. Maybe these guys aren't real. You know, maybe they're just there to make workers feel bad about themselves, or, you know, make bosses feel good about themselves.
Or to make sure that if you're being paid, you're doing not just the work that you're supposed to be doing, but you're working during that time.
Yeah.
You're getting paid for it. Kind of gets us into this issue that you take on this book that I really, that's right, paying for time.
Yeah. This is something, this is probably the most anthropological aspect of the book, but this is something that always fascinated me in the anthropology of labor and time literature, is that, you know, we measure our work by time. You know, we'll do 8 hours a day, 4 hours of this, 3 hours of that. Even Marx has this famous passage where he says that, you know, a worker working 8 hours a day is actually working 4 hours for himself and 4 hours for the boss. Yeah. So we measure all work always by time, and this just kind of makes sense. But that's not the way, you know, probably 95% of all human beings who've ever lived would ever have thought. In fact, you present that idea to them, they'd think you're just weird. Because for most people, time is measured by work rather than the other way around. When you talk about how long it takes to do something, it's like, well, you know, in Madagascar, for example, where you would often say that something takes 3 boilings of rice, and as long as it takes to cook some rice. In fact, they'd even use distance that way. Say, well, how far is it away? Well, it's about 3 boilings of rice from here, assuming someone is walking at a constant pace. So the intensity of the work isn't measured by the time, it's just assumed. And the time is measured, therefore, by the work. And that's the way most people thought and talked about these things for most of history. So as a result, it would never have occurred to anybody, you know, when you have the boss come in and say, hey, you're on my time. Stop lounging around.
Right.
I don't care if there's nothing to do. You know, straighten up the shelves. Check the inventory again. You know, whatever it might be. Which is always the most infuriating part of any real job, right? Is having to pretend to work even if there's nothing to do. So that, you know, nobody in ancient Rome did that. Nobody in medieval China did that. That concept didn't exist because work was something that is task-oriented. And you know, again, if you look comparatively at how people go about things, it's kind of like if you're a student and you're cramming for a paper and you slack off, and you suddenly say, oh no, the deadline's coming. And, you know, suddenly you go and start working and you work more and more intensely and it goes fever pitch before the big exam, and then you do it and then you party and relax and celebrate and, you know, and slowly goes back.
You may also feel bad for doing that.
Sometimes, yeah. If you do it too extremely, you don't do very well on the task. But if you're a good student, you figure out how to get it about right, you know. And this is something I find quite fascinating, that, you know.
But we call it procrastinating.
Yeah, we call it that, but it's also called normal human work patterns.
I understand where you're coming from, but I'm just saying in our society.
In our moral society, well, we blame ourselves for all this stuff, which is just the way people act in anywhere if they're left to their own devices. It's not like people throughout history have not been productive. In fact, you know, making people work at a regular pace for 8 hours a day is clearly unproductive. You know, you're only actually productive for 2.7 hours during those 8 hours anyway. Why should you be pretending? Or you're only productive for 2.7 hours worth of time because, you know, trying to draw it out actually makes you, like, not work as well. This has been discovered many times by companies that, just to see what happens, pay people the same amount but only let them, tell them to come in 5 hours a day instead of eight. And suddenly productivity by day goes up. You know, because it's just not natural to, like, force people to work at a steady pace for long periods of time. That's not what people will do. So normally people have been relatively unsupervised. They work in a task-oriented fashion where they kind of build up slowly until they kind of comes time to do something, and they speed up and coordinate and go into a big collective effort, which is often very much fun, and then they relax and celebrate and party. And that's what human beings are normally like.
So that's the farming cycle.
The farming cycle is very much like
farmers for 5,000 years.
Yeah.
And you do a lot of nothing.
Yeah, you putter around.
Work.
Yeah. There's always a season where, when I lived in Madagascar in a farming community, they have the 2 months in the fields, as they call it, where people just wake up and they're there and they're working all the time. But in the rest of the year, you know, there's no time when you see a bed where there isn't somebody in it at any hour. You know, often too. You know, there are people taking naps or like putter around, do something, go, and then. Gossiping and sort of odd tasks fills most of your time.
And even as Americans, if you travel today, you will find cultures that aren't necessarily at that level, but yet are more that way than, say, you might find here.
Absolutely. So where does this tyranny of the clock actually come from? It's a very interesting question. And Moses Finley, who's a great classicist, made this point, which always stuck with me. He said, if you look at the ancient world, ancient Greek or ancient Roman, if you talk to them and say, you're on my time or something like that, they would have looked at you like you were insane. How do you buy time? That doesn't make any sense. And in the Middle Ages, it would be considered sinful. Time belongs only to God. What are you talking about? You know, you can't buy and sell time. That's wrong. So how did that idea even come about? You have to make a whole series of mental operations. You know, traditional society like that, he said, here's a potter, he's making some pots. You can buy the pots, that's fine. You can buy the potter. Slavery was a recognized concept. But to buy the potter's time would be like renting somebody as a slave. Nobody's going to rent themselves as a slave who's a free person. And it was considered totally insulting to even suggest that to someone. Now, this is interesting, because if you look at the origins of wage labor, actually, they come out of slavery. In ancient Greece and Rome, slaves would rent themselves out. You know, or they would make a deal with their master saying, hey, look, I'll work in the potting workshop for 8 hours a day. I'll give you half the money if you let me go, you know, and do this. And they'd say, sure. So very often, and across history, you find, you know, port cities full of slaves, where the slaves would rent themselves out and give a cut to their owner or something like that. There were all these different arrangements on Madagascar, like they did that. The slaves would do all the work, and then they would, like, hire somebody to replace them at the farm where they're supposed to be working. So, okay, so slavery and wage labor have always been historically connected. But this idea that you're renting yourself out, how to make it seem like you're not actually a slave. And there is the phrase wage slavery, so for a while it was difficult to convince people that this wasn't akin to slavery, and legally it still is. I mean, you know, employment law, even in America, is ultimately is not a contract. It's not a labor contract. Under contract law, it's under master-servant law.
Hmm.
Yeah. So if you're a wage laborer, you're actually subordinate and a servant to someone. Anyway, so the question of how to do that, it all became possible once you see time as a thing. You have to have uniform measurement of time so that time isn't measured by work, but work can be measured by time. And to do that, you have to have clocks, you have to have technology, you have to have all sorts of conceptual changes. You know, if you have a sundial, after all, you know, an hour in the winter and an hour but in the summer is a completely different period
right.
of time. Right? So you need clocks which will have the same time all year round. And every city would have their clock towers. Every town would have its own time. They have to coordinate them. That's why they had to invent Greenwich Mean Time, because the trains would, like, you know, go from one city to the other. They'd be going backwards in time, because every town had a different time. So coordinating all that was a big job. I mean, in order to create industrial civilization, you had to do all sorts of things with time, which just never would have occurred to anybody normally. So you have this time system, and eventually you get to the point where you can sell work for the hour, have time. You know, punch the clock when you go into the job. Even then, it was hard. For a long time in factories, they forbid workers to bring their own pocket watches because they would be messing with the clock, you know, to make people work more. So this is important because that meant that workers had to start thinking about time. And the early labor movement, they started saying, you know, we demand an eight-hour day. We demand overtime. We demand time and a half. We demand vacation time. So, which is understandable that it happened the way it did, but what that means is you're reinforcing the idea that when you're not on your own time, then the time really does belong to the boss. So in the course of these struggles over time, time becomes reified. It becomes like this object rather than a dimension of reality. Time becomes something you can sell, which is what situation we now have. And you don't think of yourself as being a slave, which most people in history would have thought. You know, if Aristotle were alive today, I always say, he would have assumed that most Americans are slaves.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. We're in conversation with David Graeber. He teaches anthropology at the London School of Economics, and he is the author of the book that we're talking about, BS Jobs, A Theory. So this is a technological issue. You also write that this is a moral issue.
Yes.
And you trace this to Northern Europe.
Yeah, this is a very interesting thing about conceptions of work. A lot of our ideas, this is true of economics in general, a lot of economic ideas really trace back to theology and moral philosophy. Adam Smith was a moral philosopher. You know, that's what he did for a living. And it all goes back to theological debates. And there is this idea, which goes back to ancient Greece and the Bible alike, that, you know, human beings work and we produce the world, but we do so as punishment. We rebelled against God. You know, Prometheus stole fire. Adam and Eve ate from the tree of knowledge. We sort of usurped God and things that belong only to God. These powers of creation we try to take for ourselves or understanding and knowledge. As a result, you know, God is the creator. We became creators. But so God punished us by saying, you want to be like me? Okay, you can be like me. You create your own world. You'll have to produce your own food. You'll have to produce your own clothing, but it'll be miserable. I'm going to make it hurt, you know? So work is an invitation of God, which is nonetheless punishment by God. So it's necessarily painful and miserable. But it's also, there's this productivist idea that's in there, you know? That's part of the concept in both cases, that, you know, we make the world, we produce, work is productive. Now, this is a very macho idea. Like, it's very, very patriarchal. you know, men produce things, women produce babies, men produce civilization, you know. And it even says so in the Garden of Eden, you know, women will produce babies and it'll be painful, and they call that labor, right? So that's why it's the same word. So, like, production.
Same word in the...
Yeah, apparently. I'm not sure. Actually, I don't know if it's the same in Hebrew, but it becomes so in a lot of languages. And it's the same concept. Like, production is just like making stuff. It's actually literally means to push stuff out, almost as if you're giving birth. So these factories where men do painful labor and they produce stuff, cars, boom, 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 you know, and then like women have their bellies and they're producing babies. And that's painful and miserable too. And this is our punishment for defying God. But this idea that, you know, it's a sort of male production is the paradigm for all work. First of all, it's a lie. Most work isn't producing stuff. Most work isn't by men at all. So this work of maintaining things, caring for things, which is what most work has always been for most people, is made to be invisible. I always point this out to Marxists, because, you know, like, if when they give examples of work, they'll talk about, here's a cup, well, you know, it takes this much, you know, two cents worth of, you know, socially necessary labor time to produce a cup. They're always taking the example of producing a cup. And I always think, yeah, you know, you produce a cup once, you wash it like 1,000 times.
Right.
Yeah. Most work isn't about making stuff. It's about maintaining it, keeping it the same, taking care of things, taking care of people, taking care of animals and plants, you know, caretakers, caregivers. And most working class people, that's what they do. That's made to disappear. So we have this idea that work is production, it's painful production, but there's this other idea which goes deep into European, at least to the Middle Ages, that work under somebody else's discipline, work for money, wage labor, is like when you're an apprentice. But just everybody had to do this. Men and women, nobles, peasants, everybody had to spend maybe 15 years of their life being a servant and learning your trade. Even if you're a knight, you have to be a page, right? You know, you're a flunky knight learning how to be a real knight. So you're a servant, you help the guys on with his armor. Eventually you will come to the point where you get your inheritance, you get to be a real knight yourself. If you're a peasant, you do the same thing. You work on somebody else's farm. So wage labor is the time that you are learning how to be a proper adult. So working hard under somebody else's supervision is how you become a self-contained, self-disciplined adult person. And then eventually you get enough resources, since you're paid for this, that, you know, you can get your own farm or your own shop, and you become an adult, you get married, and that's how you can actually be an adult and have servants of your own, right? So everybody did that for 15 years, and then by the time they're about 30, they, you know, become a real person. Now, rise of capitalism has a very interesting effect here, because it means suddenly you have a permanent proletariat. Suddenly these people who are in a position where supposedly they're learning how to be a master craftsman will never become a master craftsman. They're trapped in permanent social adolescence. Very interesting that the breaking point is where these people say, look, I'm never going to make it. There's no way. To hell with it, I'm going to get married now. I don't care if I'm 20. And actually, if you look at the word proletariat, it means those who reproduce. That's what it literally means in Latin. So the proletariat of these people who start breeding, and there's all this, like, just like there's all this obsession with, like, unwed motherhood and things like that, you know, in recent years in a similar way, they're all Puritan moralists. Or look at these people, they can't hold themselves in, you know, they just can't, you know, keep in your pants, guys. Look, you have kids all over the place, you can't take care of them. You know, they're all getting married, like, at age 19, and common law marriage, presumably. So that's the birth of the proletariat. Now, these guys are trapped in this permanent social adolescence. They're never going to grow up. But gradually, you know, we've come to the situation where we've been playing around these ideas, work is pain, work is creation, work is self-discipline to become an adult. So essentially, we've got to this point where, all right, that old idea that work is under somebody else for money is something you do to become an adult gets transposed. You're never going to become a permanent adult, but you can be an adult on the weekends. So it's like, you know, you produce during the week and then you consume during the weekend or when you're off work. And so because, you know, it used to be your home and your workplace were the same thing. So now they're separated. So you go back and forth. Instead of like it being a life cycle thing, first you're a kid and then you become an adult. We're both alternate between being kids and adults every week.
I'm trying to get why capitalism broke up that cycle, though, of the master craftsman training somebody who then becomes a master craftsman. Is it because now things are being mass-produced, or you're moving away from craft work?
Well, I mean, that system, only people who are trained in a trade get to actually supervise it. It's exactly the opposite of the system we have now. Let's say you're going to create a factory. This is actually interesting because this is something that they had to deal with legally at the time. It used to be, you know, only a master glassmaker can supervise people making glass. Only a master ironsmith can. You know, you have to have gone through the process. You just want to set up a factory. You want glassmakers, ironsmiths, you know, all sorts of different people, ceramics guys. So you can't do that. They would sue people saying, hey, you have no training in ceramics. You can't do that. So in order to create industrial capitalism, you need to have like one guy managing people who do all sorts of different things. So you had to break up the old guild system. And the other thing is, like, you know, it was a very democratic system. Everybody gets to be a capitalist. You can't have capitalism where everybody gets to be a capitalist at some point in their life. You know, it's entirely based on the idea they have one class of people owns the wealth and another that doesn't. So they had to break that up. It was actually quite difficult to do. They had to dispossess people from their lands. They had to pass laws saying unemployment was effectively illegal. They had to do a lot of things like that. And they had to essentially set the courts in jurisdiction over labor contracts so that they could just lock people up from fleeing their jobs. I mean, labor legislation in the 18th and 19th centuries was incredibly harsh. I mean, it essentially was a state forcing people to work under conditions they never would have chosen for themselves.
We are down to the final few minutes we have together, and I want to bring it back to today and BS jobs again and ask you, as we've laid out BS jobs, how do you think this then affects our politics today?
Well, I think it actually has very profound effects that we're not willing to acknowledge. We're down to the situation where the excuse for work is essentially, it's like almost like a secular hair shirt. Now, work is our appointed suffering, which we do to deserve the consumer toys that we get for the rest of the week. All right, so if work isn't supposed to be fun, if the value of work is the degree to which we are willing to submit ourselves to the discipline of somebody we don't like doing something we don't enjoy doing, and that makes us a good person, which a lot of people directly said, you know, this is the pressure you're constantly under to sort of complain about how busy you are and how little you like doing what you do, even in places where people really aren't doing anything, they have to pretend otherwise.
And that's what makes us a good person.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So if you have that, well, it creates all sorts of very strange forms of resentment, which I think really riddle our society. And we don't think about very clearly. So, for example, you have millions of people who are trapped in these BS jobs, miserable over the fact that they don't do anything. However, there's this idea that if your work does benefit others, basically anything you get out of a job that makes it more fun, more pleasurable, feel better, then that makes it less valuable because you're not suffering. You know, so I find this all the time. I talk to friends of mine who are still intellectually alive, you know, a lot of professors have been beaten out of them, but some are still having fun and say, yeah, I can't believe they pay us to do this. This is fun. Well, why shouldn't they pay us to do something fun if it's actually benefiting other people? But, you know, we have this idea work should be suffering. It shouldn't be fun. All right. So anything you get out of a job, it's almost as if it makes it less valuable. You know, so if you're enjoying your job, that makes it less valuable. But if you're even enjoying the fact that you know you're actually helping others, that makes it less valuable. So teachers or people who are obviously doing something useful for society should be paid less. And people even say that. We don't want people who are just interested in the money teaching our kids, right? Doesn't seem to be bother them much have people who are just interested in the money running their economy, but teaching their kids, that'd be going too far. So if you're in an altruistic line of work, you shouldn't be paid much. This creates various resentments. So people in these meaningless, pointless jobs, where they get paid fairly well, often very well, resent people who have real jobs. And they might not admit it. It might not be clearly articulated. But look what happens after 2008. You know, there's a huge economic crash. Who had to take a huge pay cut? Not the bankers, right? They bailed out the auto industry. The auto executives didn't have to take a pay cut. The guys who had to take a pay cut were the auto workers, the production line workers. How did they create the 2008 crisis? You know, they were they're making cars. They're doing something which is actually useful. So all the guys who are doing the useless stuff, they're okay. But, you know, let's punish the ones who are actually doing something which we all acknowledge needs to be done, or that we want to, or Americans, we want to have cars, right? Similarly, teachers. Right-wing activists say this all the time, that, like, when they started with the school reform stuff, they targeted school administrators just as much as teachers, but nobody cared about the school administrators. But then when they started going on about teachers, everybody got really excited. So, okay, we'll go after the teachers, you know. Why? There seems to be this idea, you guys are making cars. You guys get to teach kids. That's like real work. It's really rewarding. It's good for the soul. You want lots of money, too?
You're lucky to have such a job.
Yeah, exactly. You should be happy. That should be enough for you. In England, austerity, same thing. The bankers who actually caused the crisis, they don't get to take a hit at all. Who gets to suffer from austerity? Nurses, emergency medical, you know, the guys in the ambulances, the guys who are giving you directions in the train station, the people who are actually doing something helpful. And there does seem to be this idea of like, well, you wanted to do an altruistic job? Go sacrifice for us, you know? You're that kind of person. So there's a resentment of people who have real jobs. But then there's another element. The people who have real jobs, the people in the working class, often they hate the liberal elite, as they call them, more than they hate the financial elite. I mean, usually they don't like the capitalists very much, but, you know, the ones they really sort of reserve their animus for are the guys who, like, Hollywood guys,
the intelligentsia.
Yeah. Well, why do they hate them so much? Well, I think part of the reason is they see them as the guys who've grabbed all the jobs which are actually useful, which are actually fun, and you get paid a lot. You know, so if you want to be like a human rights campaigner or a drama critic for the New York Times, or, you know, a journalist exposing corruption, you know, you want to have like a fun job, which is exciting and beneficial to humanity, and get to live a, you know, pretty nice lifestyle in Manhattan or San Francisco or someplace like that.
Those jobs are a few.
Yeah, exactly. And basically, you got to be rich. You got to come from a background where, you know, so Mr. Truck Driver in Nebraska, you know, knows that, like, if he has a smart kid, well, it's not likely he's going to become rich, but it could happen. No way he's ever going to become drama critic for the New York Times. You know, that's just not going to happen. So, of course, he resents those guys more because he says, you're the guys who grabbed all the really good jobs and you won't let us have them. Yet you claim to be these, like, men of the people, like, you know, like left-wing, you know, egalitarians. No, you're not. Okay, so the BS job class resents the working class. The working class resents the sort of cultural elite. And the whole society is riddled by these sort of simmering hatreds that kind of almost holds it together. And of course, while everybody hates the political class because, quite rightly, they believe them to be a bunch of crooks, somehow their hatred of each other makes it, like, you know, hard to bring that together to make any kind of social change.
We are out of time, but I did find it hilarious. I think you were referring to that. Having a BS job was like wearing a secular
hair shirt.
That was good. I'm sorry I didn't comment on that when you said it.
It's one of my favorite phrases.
That's a good one.
Yeah, thanks.
David Graeber, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
Again, David Graeber has been our guest. The name of his book?
We can't say, but figure it out.
BS jobs.
Yes,
I almost said it.
Oh.
But thank you again.
My pleasure.